Hey guys, welcome to Fitness Mentor's presentation of the ACE CPT online course. We are here to go over chapter 14, specifically the PowerPoint lecture. So chapter 14 directly focuses on the special populations and specifically exercise considerations for that special population. For all special populations. So really when it comes down to it, you're understanding that not all people have the same issues and understanding the different issues that they have regarding any diseases or even up things like injuries or conditions regarding their medical history or their current medical status. All of these types of people you may run into in the field, and ACE wants to prepare you to understand some of the considerations that you need as far as creating a program for them. So most of what ACE goes off of is going to be from the American College of Sports Medicine, or ACSM, and their guidelines. So that's pretty much where they're pulling most of their information from. So if you really do plan on working with special populations primarily, I would definitely encourage that you check out ACSM's certification on special populations, which I believe they have their textbook called ACSM's Guide to Exercise with Disease. It's something like that. I forget the exact title, but they have a really good book that goes over every single possible condition that you would run into and all the training parameters around that so that you can ensure safety for your clients. Anyways, let's go ahead and move over to slide number 2. And talk about SOAP, S-O-A-P. It's an acronym for assessing someone within the special populations, or that may fall into special populations. Specifically, SOAP refers to subjective assessments, objective assessments, or subjective information, objective information, the assessments, and then a plan. So you're using the subjective and objective information to determine which assessments are necessary, and then create a plan of, you know, what exercises should be performed. So subjective directly refers to a client's personal report, basically what they have to indicate about themselves, such as symptoms or challenges or progress, or you know, their current history regarding their lifestyle, stuff like that. So that's all subjective information that they will give you. Objective information is going to be information that you obtain through assessments such as vital signs, anthropometrics such as body composition, as well as blood pressure. That all kind of falls into vital signs too. Exercise, and then a nutritional log, stuff that you can collect. A nutritional log I might actually even put in subjective, as they can do it themselves. But yeah, definitely you're tracking the exercise for sure as far as objective information. And then based off of the subjective and objective information, you have an assessment. The assessments are going to be the summary of the subjective and objective observations. So what did you determine based off of that information, and how should it apply to their training program? And based off of the assessment and your analysis of that information, you create a plan. And that plan is a description of what to do as far as exercise goes, as far as maybe cardiorespiratory exercise, nutrition, maybe not that you're working with them directly through nutrition, but through a registered dietitian or medical professional. So that is the way that they utilize SOAP to create a plan for someone in the special populations. All right, so moving to slide number 3, exercise in special populations. We're basically going to start getting into each population and kind of just talk about the basic exercise considerations. I would never want you to use this PowerPoint to create a exercise program. I'd rather have you go into the ACE textbook and directly pull the information out of there when you do work with a special population person. But yeah, this is just going to kind of introduce you to some of those topics, and we'll get a little bit deeper in the audio lecture. But really, to tell the truth, when it comes down to creating a program for someone in special populations, you go into the textbook, find that chart, and create exercises directly related to all the specifications in that chart. And you could, that could be the chart from the ACE book, it can be a chart from the ACSM book, or even a medical doctor may give you specific guidelines to follow. So you aren't really creating an exercise program that's not hasn't been confirmed safe for someone in the special populations. Really rely on your external materials than your knowledge when it comes to working with someone in this case. All right, so cardiovascular disorders are going to be talked about first on slide number 3. And basically, with cardiovascular disorders, exercise should not continue if abnormal signs or symptoms are observed. If you notice someone profusely sweating, if they are extremely out of breath, if they have any numbness or tingling, or they're dizzy, syncope, all that good stuff, you definitely want to avoid or stop exercise if any of that occurs. Things like angina, dyspnea, lightheadedness, dizziness, pallor, rapid heart rate is another example. And then obviously if somebody does have a documented coronary artery disease, typically you aren't going to be working with them. More often it's a physician supervised program that they will be under, as well as they will go through a physician supervised maximal graded exercise test to ensure that their heart is healthy enough for activity. And what that does is it determines that person's functional capacity and safe levels of exercise, in which you as the personal trainer can follow the doctor's recommendations. One specific thing we want you to know about anyone with cardiovascular disease or coronary artery disease is that a client is typically recommended to perform one set of 12 to 15 repetitions using 8 to 10 exercises. I want you to write that down and kind of highlight that and know that, as that is a very safe level of exercise for most people with that. And that's what is recommended in the book. All right, moving on to slide 4, we're going to talk about hypertension. So hypertension, just some basic elements around it. What is hypertension? Hypertension is going to be high blood pressure, okay? That you need to know what high blood pressure is. That's going to be 140 over 90 or greater. What is normal blood pressure? 120 over 80. But yeah, for hypertension, 150 minutes per week may reduce systolic blood pressure by 2 to 6 millimeters of mercury or 2 to 6 pressure units. And the acute post-exercise decrease in systolic and diastolic blood pressure is healthy, anywhere from 15 to 4 millimeters of mercury for both systolic and diastolic. That basically acutely or short-term lowers blood pressure, which is very healthy. So exercise is good for this population. Just be aware, though, that some medications will alter the client's heart rate response, specifically during exercise and just at rest. What's the main one? Beta blockers. We've mentioned this before, but yeah, we definitely want you to keep that in mind, as that's typically the medicine that you need to look out for the most as a personal trainer, because it does affect the ability of the heart to beat. It slows it down, and that reduces blood pressure. But you don't want it slowing down if you're doing maximal effort activity, because then the person cannot keep up and they may get dizzy and pass out and cause other issues. So calcium channel blockers also fall into that altering heart rate response medications. All right, so hydration is also affected by diuretic medications. Be aware that diuretics can dehydrate the person. And then always, 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 and this is pretty much for all special populations across the board, but specifically we want you to know it for hypertension, that the utilizing the RPE scale is what is recommended. An RPE of 9 to 13 is recommended. Specifically, though, use the RPE scale to monitor exercise intensity for people with hypertension. All right, moving to slide number 5, as we talk about stroke. So stroke, not too frequently will you be working with people that have had a stroke or are currently having a stroke. Hopefully that doesn't ever happen to you, but you always have to be aware that it can happen. So what are some of the signs of a stroke? Sudden numbness or weakness of one side of the body, face, arms, or legs. Sudden confusion, trouble speaking, babbling, face drooping, that sort of thing. Trouble seeing in one eye, maybe both eyes. Walking problems, dizziness, loss of balance or coordination. These are more acute, like all of a sudden the person is unable to balance appropriately. Have to sit them down, maybe call an ambulance, get them to a hospital, take Advil or aspirin, as that can thin the blood a little bit to assist with passing maybe the clot if they're lucky enough. And then also a sudden or severe headache with no known cause, so be aware of that. Okay, especially when they exercise hard and all of a sudden they have a really bad headache, just be aware that they need to rest and or potentially seek medical help. Exercise recommendations for someone recovering from a stroke. So you may see someone recovering from a stroke, especially if you work with older populations. And it really depends on the client's loss of function. Some strokes are extremely severe and reduce a ton of motor control. Some do not. A lot of times it is just performing activities of daily living as an exercise program. That might be in more on the medical side of things. But yeah, you can definitely range from light or moderate intensity, like stationary cycling, water exercise, or adapted activities. 3 to 5 minute bouts is okay, but slowly work up to 30 minutes of exercise 3 to 5 days per week to get that heart rate pumping. All right, so next special population, as we move to slide 6, is going to be peripheral vascular disease. Not too common, once again, that you'll work with them, but once again, if you really focus on special populations, you may see all of these. So I guess I'll stop saying that after this slide. But what is peripheral vascular disease? It is a blood clot in an appendage. Typically, it's in the lower leg, the calf. And it results, basically the muscular pain is caused by ischemia or a lack of blood flow to a specific muscle. Typically that is caused in the lower leg, but it results in spasms or blockage of blood to the muscle. And that's called claudication, or like clots you can think of. And exercise, basic exercise recommendations for this population are low impact or no impact. So cycling is good. Jogging would be more impactful, so be aware that that's probably not recommended. Low to moderate intensity, pretty much all special populations are going to be low to moderate intensity. 10 minutes or longer for a warm-up and cool-down, so extend that warm-up and cool-down. Gradually increase total exercise by around 30 to 60 minutes. And exercise daily and avoid too cold of air that can increase vasoconstriction, which you don't want. And lessen the blood flow even further to the lower body or to the areas of the body that have intermittent claudication or peripheral vascular disease. All right, moving on to slide number 7. So we're going to talk about dyslipidemia or high cholesterol. So high cholesterol isn't necessarily a extreme condition. I almost wouldn't even put it in a very special population. They're more just overweight, probably just not too healthy. Be aware that there is a difference between slightly high cholesterol and then really high cholesterol. So if someone comes to you and says, oh, I'm on medication for high cholesterol, it'd be like, okay, well, what were your numbers? And sometimes doctors just throw people on a high cholesterol medication when their cholesterol is barely over the recommended amount, which I'm not a fan of. But cholesterol is a bit misunderstood as far as the medications around it, but it's a multi-billion dollar industry, so it kind of gets... The doctors are prescribing people that may not even need it. But anyways, that's a whole another side talk. So dyslipidemia is also what is known as high cholesterol. It's basically elevated triglycerides, lowered HDL and elevated LDL, and just high cholesterol overall in general. It does have a role in atherogenesis, which is the creation of clotting agents in the blood. Buildup of plaque in the arterial walls. And the effect on exercise, basically the goal or the effects of exercise, exercise assists in reducing high cholesterol by 3 to 5 milligrams per deciliter on average, and non-HDL cholesterol reduction by 6 milligrams per deciliter. Doesn't have a consistent effect, at least in studies, on triglycerides. There's not too much of a consistent effect on HDL, but we know that it lowers LDL, which is what the main goal of the exercise would be. But what do you want to do? You want to do moderate resistance training 3 times a week, can reduce LDL, triglycerides, and non-HDL by 6 to 9 milligrams per deciliter. Okay, so keep that in mind, that resistance training is also very important for this population. Resistance training typically increases positive sex hormones, and that can assist with lowering cholesterol. All right, moving towards diabetes, slide number 8. So diabetes is, once again, the inability to properly regulate blood glucose. There's two types of diabetes. The one that typically is most common is type 2 diabetes. That is from a lack of health in the sense of obesity, maybe some metabolic syndrome issues, prediabetes, and non-insulin dependent, meaning you produce enough insulin, but the cells don't recognize it because they're constantly being bombarded by too much insulin due to, we'll say, a lot of bad eating over a long period of time. Anyways, hyperglycemia is what is known as high blood glucose or high blood sugar levels, and especially hyperglycemia is when it's always high. Chronically elevated is what we'd say. And type 2 diabetes, once again, is non-insulin dependent. It is the most common form. 90 to 95% of all diabetes is type 2. And it presents insulin, but the cells do not recognize it and or utilize it appropriately. And more often than not, 75% of the people with type 2 diabetes are also obese. Okay, so it typically comes hand in hand. When somebody is extremely overweight, they typically do have either pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes diagnosed. All right. There is also gestational diabetes. During pregnancy, females can get diabetes, and that is a glucose intolerance that occurs during pregnancy. Doesn't affect, we'll say, the mom as much as it affects the baby. The babies typically tend to be a little bit heavier, a little bit more fat development. But it isn't always, it's not necessarily always a bad thing. It just needs to be regulated appropriately by the doctors and maybe a few more doctor's visits to ensure that the baby is safely growing. All right, type 1 diabetes and specifically exercises or exercise guidelines around type 1 exercise. So type 1 diabetes, typically the person has had it for a very long period of time, typically their whole life. So they really do know how to monitor it well. So a lot of times with type 1 diabetes, there isn't really much of a guideline that you need to stick to. I've had a client with type 1 diabetes, and she was able to monitor it completely normal, and she was a completely normal client. She had a great handle on her diabetes because she had had it her whole life, so she was always aware of how she felt and how that related to her blood glucose. But she brought her blood glucose meter to all exercises just in case she felt low. She'd measure it and insert insulin if necessary. But usually, there isn't too much of a difference between training someone with type 1 diabetes that has it controlled versus a normal client. But yeah, 3 to 5 times per week is recommended, resistance training and cardiorespiratory exercise. Just be aware that long bouts of cardiorespiratory exercise can increase the likelihood of hypoglycemia. That's one thing at the bottom there that we want you to know. And increased potential for hyperglycemia with high intensity, shorter duration, because it really spikes the release of stored glucose from the liver when you do high intensity exercise. So that you always have to be aware of that. But if you notice someone's getting lethargic that has this issue, have them check their blood sugar and then insert insulin and or eat food as needed. 55 to 75% of functional capacity or 11 to 14 on the RPE scale. It's a little bit more than most special populations because it's typically well regulated. All right, furthermore, with diabetes, so precautions for exercise with diabetes, as we look on to slide 9, avoid exercise when the glucose is 200 to 300 milligrams per deciliter, 250 to 300 milligrams per deciliter or higher. Okay, that's I would definitely make sure it's more near the 100 to 120 range for exercise. 150 would be a safer range, but yeah, as soon as it gets above near that 250 mark, you definitely want to inject some insulin to lower that, depending on the type of diabetes. If blood sugar drops below 100 milligrams per deciliter and you're exercising, you need to eat carbohydrates. Do not inject insulin into primary muscle groups. It's something that we want you to know. Injecting it into primary muscle groups, especially when they're being exercised, focuses almost all the insulin on those muscle groups and would not properly regulate blood sugar as the muscle absorbs most of it or utilizes most of it. The main goal for someone with diabetes is to develop a regular pattern of exercise and eating each day. So every single, Monday through Friday or every other day, they are exercising and eating at the same time, find out what works and stick to that pattern in order to continue exercise safely. Once again, develop a regular pattern of exercise, same time each day. That's important to know. All right, avoid exercise during peak insulin activity and then hydrate well always, and especially before and after exercise. All right, furthermore, metabolic syndrome, as we get on to slide number 10, Yeah, metabolic syndrome is going to be made up of abdominal obesity, atherogenic dyslipidemia, so maybe high cholesterol, elevated blood pressure, insulin resistance, prothrombotic state, which is an increased likelihood of thrombocytic blood clots, it's very inflamed state or pro-inflammatory state. This is very unique in the sense that it's pretty tough to get someone all the way towards metabolic syndrome in a sense that someone really needs to not pay attention to their health for quite a long period of time to get there. Meaning they haven't exercised in a very long time and they've eaten pretty average and maybe, you know, yeah, it's pretty solid getting that far in the sense of, not too often will you encounter someone with this, but you can occasionally, and this is what you need to know. So, yeah, it is presence of three or more of the above. That's metabolic syndrome. Obesity, yeah, is a major one. High blood pressure, and then insulin resistance. Those are my main three that I would focus on. If they have those three, that is metabolic syndrome. All right, and then waist circumference, men of 40 inches or more, women 35 inches or more in the waist, blood pressure above 130 over 85 or more. Yeah, I'd put it more 140 over 90 since you guys don't need to remember 130 over 85, but that's what they recommended. Fasting blood glucose is more than 100 milligrams per deciliter. And a primary treatment or objective is to reduce the risk of development of cardiovascular disease, as well as full-on type 2 diabetes. So definitely increase exercise, focus on eating and other health patterns, but low impact, non-weight bearing exercise, especially for the obese population, an RP of 11 to 13, 200 to 300 total minutes accumulated throughout the week, so a little bit more cardiorespiratory activity. You can progress from 10 to 15 minute bouts and increase, and should participate in activity 3 to 5 times per week or more, definitely as often as possible with that population to increase the health of that person. All right, next we have asthma. So asthma is going to basically be a inflammatory issue with the respiratory airways in the sense that the airways constrict to the point of where someone has trouble breathing. Typically, it's associated with pollutants or air issues, air quality issues. Sometimes even, you know, freshly cut grass, pollens, all that good stuff. But yeah, typically if somebody is known to have asthma, they definitely need to take their rescue medication with them at all times, especially when they're exercising with you, the personal trainer. So make sure that they bring that. Stay very hydrated. Avoid triggers like outside environments that are too hot or too cold. And longer warm up and cool down phases to ensure safe activity levels. All right, and then cancer is next. Cancer, the main goal is to improve quality of life. So there's not a lot the exercise will do as far as reducing or eliminating or curing cancer, but the main goal is to not allow that person or it basically keeps them, their body feeling better through the process. And that's what that improvement in quality of life refers to. It can reduce nausea and vomiting, and it can improve and maintain conditioning and muscle mass through the whole treatment. But definitely consult with a physician to determine what's safe and the specifics around exercise and that population. All right, moving to slide number 12, as we talk about osteoporosis. So osteoporosis is a pretty unique one as far as personal training and resistance training goes, because people that perform resistance training very rarely get osteoporosis, and that's specifically weight-bearing activity. That's because exercise, specifically resistance training, assists in the bone-building process. Okay, so someone that has osteoporosis has most likely not been performing resistance training on a regular basis. What does it do? Bone mineral density that is 2.5 below the standard deviation or more for young adults. That's basically a low bone mineral density. And osteopenia is not quite full on osteoporosis, but it's a lessened bone mass, bone mineral density. And then increasing bone mineral density is great through weight-bearing exercises. Okay, some plyometric exercises as they progress can be beneficial as well, but obviously be careful if they are have severe osteoporosis and or are really old with plyometric exercise, because you want to make sure they are in a safe environment that is and they can balance. One thing I do want to point out is that the quadruped bird dog is great for osteoporosis. This basically is a non-weight-bearing core exercise, and that I just want you to know that as that it would be best for someone with osteoporosis. Okay, avoid the below for clients with spinal issues or fractures. You'd always pretty much want to avoid spinal loading in the beginning stages until they can build up more bone mineral density. But also avoid spinal flexion like crunches and bent over rows specifically. Someone with osteoporosis would want to avoid bent over rows. Avoid jumping and high impact aerobics. Okay. Trampolines and step aerobics are not recommended. Abducting the legs against resistance, as the hips are not that strong. Pulling on the neck or hands behind the head, meaning mainly crunches in which you're pulling your head forward. You don't want that. All of that is to protect and reduce the likelihood of fractures. So, next population, page 13, slide 13, is arthritis. Arthritis might be a little bit more common in or that you might see that a little bit more frequently, anything or anywhere from osteoarthritis to rheumatoid arthritis, definitely more common than some of the others, as especially in the aging population, you know, in that 50 and above, 40 and above, people start to, their bodies start to have or be affected from their previous activities in their life, as osteoarthritis, and then rheumatoid arthritis is a disease, a autoimmune disease that needs to be considered very closely with exercise guidelines. You need to follow those pretty closely. But the two most common forms of arthritis, like I mentioned, is osteoarthritis. That's a wearing of the articular cartilage and causing, we'll say, pain and or less cushioning of the joints. Rheumatoid arthritis is going to be the autoimmune disease in which the body's immune cells are attacking the joints, causing constant pain, lack of mobility, things like that. Classifications, though, are important to understand. Class 1, it basically all relates to the ability to perform the normal activities of daily living. Class 1, they're fine. Class 2, they can perform most things, but some things like work-specific tasks they might not be able to perform. Class 3, they can do most self-care, but very limited in vocational or avocational activities, on-the-job sort of duties. Class 4 is basically they are almost unable to care for themselves. It's very severe arthritis, so keep that in mind. But yeah, there's some exercise guidelines in the book that you should definitely closely follow and research if you do run into a client with this. Also, guys, one of the main things for arthritis is managing the pain that they have, meaning the clients, if they have pain during a specific exercise, modify the exercise to where they do not have pain or have a significantly less pain. Very important there too. All right, slide number 14. We're going to talk about fibromyalgia. Okay, so now just kind of getting to some of the lower likelihood ones that you'll see in the field. But exercise for fibromyalgia improves pain management and increases quality of life. Chronic fatigue syndrome. The main thing that you want to focus on with that type of client would be to rest significantly more. Chronic fatigue syndrome is basically the adrenal glands increased stress hormone. That's what I'll say. Increased cortisol, increased adrenaline, epinephrine is going to be chronic in that person, in which they do not recover as easily. So utilizing a 1 minute on with 3 minute rest to ensure adequate recovery is important. Okay. And then low back pain is next. So low back pain is very, very common. I wouldn't consider it a special population because so many people have it. But there is severe levels of back pain that you will encounter that really, if it's extremely severe, it's going to be something like a herniated disc, bulging disc, deteriorating disc, arthritis in the spine or neck, Oh, yeah, low back pain would be lower spine. More often than not, you need really, really, really need to manage pain. Avoid all pain, especially in that low back region. But they also say to avoid forward flexion, specifically unsupported forward flexion, twisting at the waist or turning or with turned feet. So avoid twisting, especially when carrying a load. That's very important. Lifting both legs simultaneously when the prone or supine position can put pain in the low back. And then rapid movements are definitely should be avoided. All right, so now we're going to talk a little bit about nutrition and other elements of special populations. Yeah, they don't talk much, almost any, about nutrition in this entire book. So we kind of added this for you to understand a little bit more about eating regarding weight management. But the main sort of idea currently, as far as weight reduction, is to encourage a reduced energy intake and an increased energy output or exercise. So decrease calories while decrease calories that are eaten and increase calories that are expended to achieve a deficit of 500 to 1,000 calorie deficit per day. Okay. 3,500 calories are in 1 pound of fat. That's something that you need to know. The main reason why you need to know 3,500 calories are in 1 pound of fat is because with a 500 calorie deficit per day over 7 days equals 1 pound of fat lost per week. And you may have some math that makes it onto the test regarding that. Okay, meaning 500 calories times 7 days is 3,500. If you want to lose 1 pound a week, if you stay in a 500 calorie deficit, you will lose around 1 pound, typically. There is a very, very huge hormonal element to fat loss. So definitely be aware of that. I'm not a big calorie guy. I don't follow any caloric recommendations with my clients or myself, and we still lose a lot of fat because we focus on eating well, sleeping well, exercising, and managing our stress. Okay. Typically, most of my clients are in a caloric surplus and losing fat because of the foods that they choose. Yeah, obviously, reducing calories can definitely help with that, but yeah, it's not the only way. But for ACE, what do they recommend? Absolutely, it's a caloric deficit. How much? 500 to 1,000. And how much to lose 1 pound per week? 500 calories per day. Okay. All right. Also be aware of signs of bulimia, though, and anorexia. What is bulimia? Bulimia is overeating and purging, also known as binging and purging. Just be aware of that. It is important to recognize certain signs in order to assist someone and help someone if they do have an issue like that. So, yeah, you do need to know bulimia and anorexia for sure what they are. But yeah, binging and purging for bulimia, meaning you eat a ton and then you throw it up. Anorexia is just you do not eat enough food to the point of the body goes into a starvation state. All right, and then moving on to slide number 16, we're going to talk about specific populations, older adults and youth. Older adults and youth typically come up in almost every chapter as they do require a little bit more emphasis as far as exercise guidelines. For older adults, definitely every older adult is going to be different, but make sure, yeah, see a physician's guidelines before beginning any exercise. And also one thing that you can do with an older client is to perform what's called a clearing test to make sure that there's no pain associated with any specific movements. A clearing test basically clears each exercise for you to use because there's no pain associated with that movement. Okay, keep that in mind as that could or that should be performed more often than not with older adults. All right, sensory system is affected in older adults. Their central nervous system may not be as primed, visual, basically relied on for balance. They're very visual. Vestibular, their inner ear balance and coordination what is going to provide them positioning of the head in space, more or less balance from the head side of things. And then somatosensory is basically going to impact balance and coordination. Somatosensory is basically more than just the vestibular system, but how all senses kind of work together to enhance balance and coordination. All right, youth definitely is considered a special population. The main thing with youth is you typically don't have disease, you typically don't have injuries, you typically don't have special considerations around exercise. It's more just mimic play. Focus on building motor control, motor skill development, balance, coordination, activities that they enjoy, play. It's the main focus. And final slide, as we get to slide number 17, is also we want to always consider pre- and postpartum females. That is, some personal trainers really focus on working solely with this population, people or females that have recently given birth or are currently pregnant, do want to stay in shape. And this is a good population for some of the personal trainers, as they can really focus on helping mothers in that sense. But yeah, pregnancy should, you should always acquire a physician's clearance, because most or some females may not be cleared by their doctor to exercise, depending on their type of pregnancy or the positioning of the baby. Always be aware. Use the RPE scale to monitor intensity. Also, yeah, basically always exercise at a comfortable level. That's something that's very important. The talk test can be used for that for sure. I went to the store and I bought bananas. and then avoid jumping, hopping, skipping, bouncing, or running, especially high intensity activities around those. Don't want to jolt the baby too much. Deep knee bends, full sit-ups, double leg raises. Yeah, you don't need to do much core work during pregnancy. And then contact sports, obviously not bouncing while stretching. And then activities where falling is likely. You want to make sure there's always balance involved, or appropriate balance, safe, or to where the person can balance safely. And then after the first trimester, be aware that longer than 5 minutes in a supine position is discouraged, meaning the second and third trimester, do not lay or do not perform exercise for more than a few minutes in the supine or prone positions, as that could decrease blood flow to the baby or potential for fetal hypoxia. All right, so hopefully that gives you guys a good little intro into the types of special populations and some of the basic considerations you need to have for that those populations. All right, so go ahead and complete the audiobook lecture below. Yeah, as far as below, we do have a good amount of lecture. We get into a little bit more detail around those, a little bit more insight into each population. Then complete the assignment for this chapter. There are a decent amount of questions from this chapter that can make it onto the test, so definitely pay attention to those assignment questions, and then pass the quiz down below. All right, that should be it. So I will see you guys down at the audio lecture, audiobook lecture right down below. Cheers.